Lots of buzz out there about Donna Tartt's new novel, The Goldfinch, which Stephen King raved about in last week's issue. This week, the author, also of The Secret History, joins us to talk about The Goldfinch.
Hobie took a long time to really bring into focus exactly the way I wanted him to be, because he doesn't speak much.
Where has Bridget Jones been, and can she possibly be 51?
Women in their 40s and 50s are not disappearing women. They've still got it going on.
Helen Fielding is here to talk about Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy. Who was Benjamin Franklin's favorite sister?
She spent her entire life caring for very young children and burying many of them.
Jill Lepore will tell us about her biography of Jane Franklin, Book of Ages. Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles will be here with the latest bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Donna Tartt, author of The Secret History and now The Goldfinch, is here to talk about her new novel. Donna, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
There will be no plot spoilers here because I am on what page? I am on page, I think, 302.
About halfway.
So fear not, those who have not finished the book. I have to start just talking for a second about The Secret History, because when we all saw that you had a new novel coming out, and your first since for 11 years, right?
The Little Friend was in 2002, I believe.
Okay. There was such excitement, and we all talked about, remember when you read The Secret History? And I remember I read The Secret History in 1994. I was backpacking through China. And remember, you know, I just wanted to get back to my hotel room to keep reading The Secret History. It was like, never mind what was going on up there.
Oh, that's wonderful. I have memories of books like that as well, that I was on difficult vacations and the only thing that saved me was this book. Right. I had a terrible trip to Africa once, and the only thing that saved me was Alex Haley's Roots, which I happened to have with me, and I was so glad I did.
I mean, that book and now The Goldfinch, it's such a sweeping novel and so absorbing. I have to ask the very basic question, where did you get the idea?
The idea came from lots of different places. There wasn't one idea. The Secret History, my first novel, did very well in Holland, and as sort of a consequence, I spent a good deal of time in Amsterdam. The Amsterdam section of this book goes back to notes I'd been making 20 years or more, since 1993. I wrote a lot while I was there. And then I wrote The Little Friend, which was a Mississippi book. And much of what I write doesn't actually make it into a finished book. But I always did know that I wanted to write about Amsterdam and also about New York. New York, New Amsterdam. New York is New Amsterdam, you know.
And you live half the time in New York,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do. I've lived here since 1987. I came here first to live in 1987. And it's really where I feel most at home in the world now.
And the New York-iness of the book really comes across. It starts, of course, in New York with the young protagonist, 13 years old at the time, Theo Decker, and this horrible cataclysmic event that takes place at the Met and then sets everything in motion. It just felt like you really got the city so well, that sort of uptown private school social milieu and the Park Avenue, and then the Hobie downtown.
Well, I was always very interested in that, and was from the very first, the contrast in the city, which were much stronger when I first saw the city for the first time. When I first came here in 1987, New York City was a pretty, it was rougher. The rough
yes.
edges of it were a lot rougher. I remember one of my very first days in New York, I went down to the Bowery, which is nothing like it is now.
Right, of
went
course.
Down to the Bowery with a friend of mine who was going to one of those restaurant supply shops down there. She was equipping a restaurant upstate. And car on fire, just boom. I just thought, what a city, my gosh. You know, it was just, you know.
And probably nobody
Quentin
blinked
Tarantino.
An eye.
No, people were just walking past it. Right. And this city is so many different cities.
Right.
It's five different cities. One of my teachers at Bennington used to say, New York is the only city in the world that you don't ever have to travel. You can be in New York your whole life and you never know it. There's always that room. There's always that door. There's always that... You always see those curtains, but what's going on behind there? Nobody ever knows the whole city. There's always a secret here.
And did you, speaking of traveling, go out to Las Vegas?
I did.
Because, I mean, it's very vivid, the scenes that take place in this sort of desolate, half-abandoned suburban development. Was this canyon, Shadow Canyon, I can't remember the exact name, an actual place?
When I first began writing the book, it was between New York and Amsterdam. It was those were the two poles of it.
Mm-hmm.
There was something missing, and I'd been working on the book for about 3 years, and I wasn't quite happy with it. And then just by chance, I happened to take a trip to Las Vegas. And I didn't really want to go, and I thought I had an idea of what Las Vegas was like, and that wasn't anything I was going to be very interested in. And I was very surprised by the city. Las Vegas really brings into the foreground a lot of questions about authenticity and fakes.
Yes.
You have a fake Eiffel Tower, you have fake pyramids, you have Caesar's Palace and all these reproductions of classical antiquity which look very much like reproductions. It's a completely artificial city. But then I was in the Bellagio and saw an exhibition of French Impressionist paintings,
mm-hmm.
because they have little museums there. And to see the real works in this setting, just many different things started to click about how art is often tied up with dirty money, you know,
right.
about chance and luck and all sorts of things. Theo's dad was always a gambler, but I had never really thought to put him in Las Vegas, and then it was just an obvious thing. And then I ended up spending, I think, what my friends would consider a fairly odd amount of time in Las Vegas.
Well, what was so interesting is that there's that Vegas that you know, and then you take it a step removed and think, well, what about all the families who are here?
Exactly, the people who work in the casinos,
right.
and the real people who live there.
And these sort of transient lifestyles and the contrast between this social milieu that Theo experienced in his life in a New York City private school versus what was, you know, cool and what was even normal among the kids who were at this desert school.
It's very funny flying into Las Vegas, particularly if you fly in at night. It's just blackness, 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 and then this blaze of light just out of nowhere. It is very much like going to another planet, and it's the way that the lawns are watered and manicured, and then beyond you can just really see just brown desert and nothing. I mean, as you go out past the tended part, then it becomes like the treasure of the Sierra Madre. It's really
right.
desert. It's scary desert.
I felt relieved when we leave Las Vegas in the narrative, because at least up to the point where I am, this is a very Dickensian period, and I'm not the first, I think, to point out the Dickensian elements of the story, and I just, all my maternal instincts were kicking in and saying, you know, no, Theo, don't do that, and no, that's not the right decision, get out, run, don't listen to Boris. It was interesting, too, in your By the Book, which is in this week's issue, you mentioned that Dickens is one of your favorite novelists.
He is.
Was that a conscious decision to sort of have these references to Dickens throughout the novel? Or
it's funny. They just sort of happened. I love Dickens so much that he's really internalized in some way. The books are more inside me now than they are outside me. I started reading him when I was very young and have always loved him. And he's someone who's inexhaustible in the manner of Shakespeare. He was a writer that I really learned how to do a lot of what I, when I was learning to write, because there's no technical task that Dickens doesn't do well. He does everything well. He does metaphor well. He's a great stylist line to line. He's great at character. He's great at foreshadowing. He's great at suspense. He's humorous. He's funny. He'll have a ghost in there, you know. There's nobody in the history of literature that could have had a character spontaneously combust like Crook did in Bleak House. And you believe it.
Yes.
No one else could pull that off in a serious novel. He does. The amazing thing about Dickens is that Dickens is a very generous writer. Dickens really does say to a young writer, he sort of beckons you behind the scenes and says, hey, kid, let me show you how I do this. If you look, he leaves the wires and rigging behind the stage and he lets you see it. A lot of writers aren't like that. Joyce, for example, doesn't want you at all to see how he achieves any of his effects.
Because you could never do it anyway.
You could never do it anyway, and there's a curtain down, he's presenting something, and he's not generous with his secrets. Dickens is very generous with his secrets. He will show you how to do anything that you want to learn from him. He's a wonderful teacher.
When you drawing the portraits that you drew, the characters in this novel, I would say especially Hobie and Boris, feel very Dickensian, but everything, and very different from Dickens in other ways, is very sharply observed. The descriptions of Theo's mother and of Mrs. Barbour are so highly specific and wonderful. Did you have certain characters in mind as you were working on the book, or they just kind of emerged through, or did you start off with Theo? And
some characters were very much in focus and clear focus from the beginning. Others took a long time. Hobie took a long time to really bring into focus exactly the way I wanted him to be, because he doesn't speak much.
Right.
And
he's the great listener.
He's the great listener. And that's actually a rather hard character to write. It's hard to characterize somebody who's a good listener. You have to
do
it all by
sort of saintly and...
Exactly. I really wanted him to be human, to be complicated, and he didn't come easily. Whereas Boris was just kind of a gift. Boris was just sort of there and talking, and I'm
going to start talking like him. Like, you could completely hear that voice. It was very infectious. The painting. Did you know that this was about this particular painting, or did it start off with the boy blowing bubbles, or, you know, some other image?
I actually considered several other paintings. It was always about a boy becoming obsessed with a painting and taking a painting. But this one was really the only one. From the time I saw this one, I knew that this was it.
When you first saw the painting, what do you remember?
I first saw the painting at Christie's Amsterdam, and I was very struck at first. It was a copy, a 19th century copy. But I was startled when I found out that it wasn't a 19th century painting, that it had really been painted much, much earlier, because it doesn't look like a painting of the 1600s. It doesn't look like a painting done by Rembrandt's pupil. The placement of the bird, the fact that it's a living bird, the scale of it, even the fact that he signs his name, that his signature is quite so prominent. I was very surprised and moved by this painting. And I think maybe the most moving thing, the thing that caught me and that still always catches me, because I have a reproduction of this painting in my office and I looked at it every day for 10 years. But the thing that always catches me is you don't notice that chain at first.
Yes.
He's so brave, and he's sitting there, and he's just so dignified and quiet, and then you see that little chain around the foot just barely there.
Is that what ultimately made it, the painting for this story?
Absolutely. Hope and hopelessness. I mean, he's a brave little thing, but he's caught.
All right. That's a great note to end on, because I don't want to reveal any more of the plot to listeners who haven't started the book, or those who, like me, are halfway through. So, Donna, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Pamela.
That was Donna Tartt, author of The Goldfinch.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Empty Mansions, The Mysterious Life of Huguette Clark and the Spending of a Great American Fortune by Bill Dedman and Paul Clark Newell. That's Empty Mansions, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us now with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on?
Award season continues in earnest, and in the muddle of which award is being announced which week, we had a very busy last few days, and the real headline is that the Man Booker Prize was announced this week, and the winner was Eleanor Catton, who is a New Zealander born in Canada, and she was a really interesting pick for a couple of reasons. One is that she was only 28 years old.
So that's a big first. She's the youngest.
Very big first. She was the youngest, and her book, The Luminaries, was 848 pages, which made it the longest book ever to win the Booker, and it beat out the closest book, Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, by about 200 pages. So it wasn't even close.
It's all that youthful energy. She could just type so quickly.
Yes, I think she started writing the book when she was something like 25 years old, and she's relatively unknown in the United States. The Times reviewed her first book, but the second book just came out this week.
And she, though, spent some time here, right? Didn't she study at Iowa?
She did. She has an MFA from Iowa, which is a rite of passage for many young American writers. But she's still someone who, you know, is definitely not a household name in America. But the Booker, even though it is administered in London and handed out in London, it's a prize that has a lot of pull among American readers. The books that are winners every year always get a huge bump in sales and in recognition, even in the United States.
Well, it's our obsession or fascination with all things Brit and somewhat exotic, since it's also from English-speaking countries in the Commonwealth, right? Is that the...
Yes, it's Britain and all the other Commonwealth countries.
But now that's going away.
It is going away. This is the final year. 2013 is the final year before the Man Booker Prize will be corrupted by the Yanks. next year, the eligibility has changed so that the books that are eligible for the prize have to have been published in the UK and written in English, which, as the prize administrator said, opens it up from China to Chicago. So it'll really make it a very different prize. I think that the concern among many people in the UK is that it will make it much harder for debut authors, for smaller, less known authors to get their books shortlisted, longlisted, and we'll see what happens.
All right, watch out for those Iowans. Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
I'm mad about the boy, and I know it's stupid to be mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy.
So I'm very excited to have Helen Fielding here. She is the author, of course, of Bridget Jones's Diary, and has a new Bridget Jones book, Mad About the Boy, that is reviewed in this week's issue by Sarah Lyle. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in. So you're here from London.
Yep.
And touring around all around the U.S.? Or?
Yes, I'm going to New York now, and then Chicago and Washington, and then Canada, and then the West Coast, and then finally Miami.
So I was thinking about what I wanted to ask you about this novel, and the first thing I thought of, which I just had to ask, is it hard in your mind to sort of get the image of Renee Zellweger out of your mind as Bridget Jones while you're working on this, or do you just sort of welcome it in, or do you just have your own image of her?
I think it is really interesting, the effect the films have on you as a novelist. I suppose from the Bridget perspective, because that's the eye that sees, because it's a first-person diary, I don't ever really imagine Bridget in my mind, but I do imagine all the other characters. So I suppose with Daniel and Mark Darcy, of course, they're completely mixed up with Colin Firth. And
it's not a bad image to have in your
head. It's not a bad image at all. And in fact, they were quite instrumental, very instrumental in creating the characters as they are now. I mean, those lines in the first movie where Daniel's seducing Bridget and she's got the big mummy pants, which we now call Spanx, on, and he goes, "Oh, don't worry, I'm wearing something rather similar myself." Oh, mummy. That was all from Hugh. That was him ad-libbing.
That was ad-libbing.
And of course, I based the original Mr. Darcy on Colin Firth playing Mark Darcy. You see, I got them all mixed up.
Right.
I based Mark Darcy on Colin Firth playing Mr. Darcy. So
In the wonderful BBC Pride and Prejudice with, yes.
I've never been able to separate any of them in my mind at all.
Did it change the effect of writing this novel then, in terms of sort of the way you imagined the dialogue and pictured the characters then in your head versus when you were writing it, the first novel, and of course the film hadn't yet been cast?
Well, I think this one came to me quite organically, and it wasn't actually even a Bridget novel when I started writing it. I have a note in my diary from March the year before this one.
So the diary doesn't come out of nowhere.
No, the diary concept. But it was just like, I wonder if I could write a book about, and it was basically about a woman older getting back into the dating scene when the landscape's completely changed.
Right.
And dealing with children and technology and all those things that didn't exist. Well, children existed, but Bridget didn't have children the first time round. And as I wrote, I realised the voice was Bridget's. And I suppose I slightly resisted making it a Bridget yes. Jones novel because I knew of the expectation that had come with the movies, but I didn't tell anyone that I was doing it. And that allowed me to write privately and without thinking about what anyone else would think or expect, just express what I wanted to express and tell the story that I wanted to tell, which I think is what you have to do as a writer. You have to write from the inside out.
You'd written two novels since the previous Bridget Jones,
I've written actually quite a few. I've written quite a few that I've dumped because I have aspirations to be literary.
You could say this is literary.
You could say, and it would be nice if you did. I've written several quite intense novels, and I was writing A Tale of Two Cities with Los Angeles and the Yorkshire mill town I was brought up in. And, mm-hmm. and it was all rather portentous in tone, and it was absolutely hopeless, and no one would have read more than three pages. So I stopped that. But I always do write. It's like not having my handbag if I don't write. I have to keep writing a bit every day, and have, even if I'm never going to do anything with it.
So you knew you had to get Bridget back to being a singleton. Did you know that you were going to kill Mr. Darcy? I hope I'm not revealing. The spoiler alert has already happened. So.
I think it's happened. It's a funny thing when you're writing a novel. It's in my imagination, that is just what happened. You know, when I wrote Bridget, I was in my 30s, she was, and presumably most of the people reading it were, and life moves on. And as everyone knows, as life moves on, stuff happens. Sad things happen, people die, and yet you carry on. And you still have the joie de vivre. Bridget still has that sense of fun and the ability to pick herself up and KBO keep buggering on. She still has the old friends around her. Mark would never have left her. He's the quintessential gentleman. I found it quite touching that people cared about him so much.
Yes.
It was on the BBC News.
Aww.
After the Syrian crisis, Mark Darcy is dead.
Oh, no. But which one upset people more? How had Bridget Jones changed as a character in the intervening years between this novel and the previous one?
To me, she actually inside has not changed that much. And that's one thing that I found interesting about writing it, because I did wonder whether to leave her age vague. In the first novel, I actually never said her age.
How old was she?
I just put she was in her 30s. And then I
thought, you have an idea in your head?
Not really.
Yeah.
I think I was probably 36 when I wrote it, 35 or something. And I thought, oh, should I just leave it vague? And then I thought, do you know what? I'm going to say she's in her 50s. Because I think there's a misperception of what women are like, women of a certain age. I hate that expression.
Right. Well, she looks awfully cute on the cover.
That model is 56. And, you know, the sort of the sense that you might either become a sort of Anita Bruckner character who just sits staring morosely at a lake, or you start knitting. And, you know, that when I wrote the first Bridget, there was this notion of Germaine Greer's disappearing woman.
Right.
And what I'm seeing around me is that women in their 40s and 50s are not disappearing women. They've still got it going on. They're still,
they have a lot more procedures to turn to maintain that look.
But they're still dating if they're single.
Right.
And they're still as they were inside. They're still the same people. And they're still laughing. They're still going out for a drink with their friends. They're still wearing the same sort of clothes. And why shouldn't they be? And I think, you know, just as the idea of the single 30-something woman was the tragic barren spinster, and that was very outdated,
mm-hmm.
I think the notion of the tragic 50-something disappearing woman who's just doing knitting is ridiculous, and we need to get rid of it.
So you mentioned that this made major headlines, BBC, when it was revealed that Darcy was dead. Do you find in general that the reception of the novel is different in the UK from the way it's perceived here?
It's interesting because when Bridget first came to America, there was a letter from Christopher Hitchens in the Evening Standard saying, don't bring her to America. They won't understand. They don't understand self-deprecation. And it's a different kind of humour, which of course was not true at all. And I don't find the reception much different. I think perhaps the thing about London is that, unlike America, everything is in one city. Politics, movies, television, theatre, literature, all in one place. So it's a very intense reaction to anything. And I actually found it quite touching that people are so attached to Bridget after all this time as a character. There is a feeling of possession about her. And I think that's, for a writer, given that, you know, I was a freelance journalist who created this character by accident in a column that I thought would be stopped for being too silly. It's an amazing thing to happen. It's an amazing reaction.
Well, there's a tradition of those kind of columns becoming major characters over here too, with, you know, Candace Bushnell turning Sex and the City into a whole mega franchise.
I think there's something quite good about a character being written in the form of a column, because one of the things I love about 19th century novels, a lot of which were written like that, is that they are both a slice of life and they make you want to turn the page. You don't have to choose between those two things.
Did you ever find writing in the diary format constraining, where you just sort of wanted to burst forth into Jane Austen land? Or,
well, I've got a very good friend, Miley Malloy, who's a wonderful writer, and I was talking to her once about exposition, because I always feel like I have to go through everything in diary form. She says you can just say that this happened and this happened and that happened. And I did do that a bit in this novel, and I found it really liberating. But I suppose I do write very visually. I see things, scenes, especially the big scenes, like the scene where Bridget goes to the party with the younger man in this one. I sort of based that on, there was an advert for Shrink Fit Levi's years ago, set to Dinah Washington's Mad About the Boy. I'm mad about the boy. And then it was in suburbia, and this boy dived through all the swimming pools and created sort of havoc. And so I wrote a scene like that, where Bridget, having been pitied by all her smug married friends for her widowed status, and they're all coming out with these prejudices like, oh, you know, a man of Bridget's age widowed would have women throwing themselves at him, but nobody wants a woman Bridget's age, rather like the uncles used to do.
Right.
And so there's this great scene where she goes to the party with the younger man, and they're all, their whole socio-economic view of life is suddenly shifted amongst the smug married.
Well, I've gotten you to sing, so I feel like I've succeeded, and we should stop just there. Thank you so much for coming in, Helen. That was Helen Fielding, author of the new Bridget Jones book, Mad About the Boy. Thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
I'm feeling quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad about the boy.
Jill Lepore joins us. She is the author of a new book, Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Hi, Jill.
Hey.
Thanks for coming in. I'm interested in every aspect of this title. First of all, Jane Franklin.
Jane Franklin is Benjamin Franklin's little sister. There were 17 Franklin children. I'm relieved to report there were two wives. So there were 10 boys and 7 girls. Benjamin was the youngest boy and Jane was the youngest girl.
They were Jenny and Benny.
Jenny and Benny.
And very close.
Really close. So 6 years apart in age, and there was a sister between them. But they lived longer than all the other Franklin children. For a lot of their lives, they were the only two children left. And although Franklin ran away from home when he was 17, so Jenny was 11 then, they had this lifelong correspondence. They corresponded for 63 years. Benjamin runs away from home when he's 17. The first letter he writes home when he's 21, he writes to Jenny, and then writes to her, you know, up till a few days before his death, 63 years later. But the first 30 years of that correspondence, all we have are his letters, because she saved all the letters he sent to her. She put them in his little trunk. And the letters that she sent to him, he probably just misplaced. I mean, he had a lot of correspondence, Benjamin Franklin did.
Right.
And he didn't. It wasn't as precious to him as it was to her.
This book was just longlisted for the National Book Award. Congratulations. And I think one of the many reasons why is just the scholarship that required then. I mean, how did you go about finding out about this woman when she obviously was not the celebrated figure like Ben Franklin, and she didn't leave much of a paper trail?
You know, there's this Virginia Woolf essay about Judith Shakespeare. What would have happened if Shakespeare had a sister, you know? And Woolf imagines this sort of fictional Judith Shakespeare and how she would have gotten pregnant when she was a teenager and run away from home, gotten pregnant, and killed herself. And that was sort of what Virginia Woolf could imagine, because she couldn't really imagine being so gifted as William Shakespeare was and then finding herself with child. Well, you know, Jane may well have been as gifted as Franklin. She married at the age of 15. She had 12 children. She's not a figment of my imagination, and that was what felt important to me about the story, differently than the kind of thought experiment that's Virginia Woolf's Judith Shakespeare essay, was to sort of say, okay, what does it actually mean to be possibly quite brilliant and to live this life of incredible confinement and, right, and intellectual deprivation? What does it mean to not be taught to write as a matter of course? Girls were not taught in the 18th century to write. It was really uncommon that Jane learned how to write at all.
And you open it with this great quote from Benjamin Franklin about how the other half
Half of the world doesn't know how the other half lives. And I really think that, you know, in the way that we think about Benjamin Franklin's life story as an allegory, like, it's not so much about Franklin, the rags to riches, self-made American story. It's really an allegory for the whole country, sort of idea of America. You know, Jane's story is an allegory too. It's just everybody else's allegory. It's like for those of us who have a rags to rags life.
Tell us about the title of the Book of Ages.
You know, Franklin famously wrote the story of his life, and it's this wonderful, funny, truly fascinating document. A lot of feminist theorists over the years have been like, well, what would women's autobiography look like from this period? And there isn't really very much. And I came across this document that was referred to as Jane Meacham's Book of Ages in an archive in Boston. And I was so excited about it. And I went to see it. And it's this little, tiny little book that she stitched together out of four sheets of foolscap that she folded together to make 16 pages, the roughest, coarsest, like if you ever made homemade paper,
right,
it's like that. On the cover, she's written Book of Ages. That's a title she gave. And you
was
know,
that a common thing?
No, it's a phrase that you just do not find anywhere else in the 18th century. It sort of really means a book of the dead. And it begins, you know, Jane Franklin born March 27, 1712. Like the way Franklin's story begins, you know, with his birth. And you think, like, this is a female autobiography. What a discovery. What a find. This is great. But then you page through it, and it's a chronicle of the births and then the deaths of each of her 12 children.
Which really was a story of the time.
It's just the story of her. Like, the story of her life is not the story of her life. It's the story of the children that she bore and their fates. That is her story. And there isn't a sort of autobiography there. Like, that's not what the story of a woman's life is in the 18th century.
What does it tell us about her life? I mean, she married a lout, a saddle maker, who was not a great husband.
Yeah, and I think one of the things, like the first thing you see when you start reading the Book of Ages is she gives the age at birth and then the age at which she marries, and you do the calculations, or she's 15 years old. And, you know, maybe we kind of carry around, oh, yeah, people used to get married. No, they didn't. The average age of marriage in Massachusetts at the time was 24.
Wow.
Like, the youngest any of her siblings got married was, like, 22. Franklin married at 24. Her mother married at 22. All her sisters married 23, 24, 25.
Do we know why?
So we don't. Like, it's with everything else with Jane Franklin, it's like, she's a dark room and Benjamin Franklin is the candle. So yeah, if he's not there, you can't see anything.
Right.
You're just in the dark. And he wasn't there when she got married. And we don't have any, you know, correspondence from her from that time in her life. I would have assumed, because it was illegal to marry in Massachusetts unless you were 16, you had to have your parents' permission. So her parents had to give permission. Guy was a lout and a drunk and, it turns out later, insane. I don't think they would have given her permission to marry if she hadn't been pregnant. So I think she was probably pregnant and
right,
lost the baby.
And let's talk about those 12 children. What happened with them?
A number of them died in infancy, like they didn't get through the first year. I mean, one in four children died before the age of 10, but most of those deaths are really during infancy. There's
right,
just different kind of peaks. So a lot of those were very young children that she buried, including her very first child died a few weeks before its first birthday.
And then a number of her children reached adulthood and married and had children of their own, only then very quickly to die. So then Jane raised her grandchildren, like when her daughter died. And then she had like a granddaughter that she had raised, who's also named Jane, who had four children and then died in childbirth. And then she raised her great-grandchildren. So like most women of her station, a woman living in relative poverty and obscurity her whole life, she spent her entire life caring for very young children and burying many of them.
You call the book in the subtitle not just the life of Jane Franklin, but the opinions of Jane Franklin. What do we know about her opinions? You would think she'd be opinionated given who her brother was.
Yeah. Well, I was trying to think about how to play in this book a little bit with the conventions of 18th century writing. You know, at one point I thought, well, I'll write it like Pamela, you know, and just sort of think about
that book.
Richardson, yes. And now I'm going to wonder if every Pamela I meet is actually named after Samuel Richardson's heroine.
I'm just glad it's not Shamela.
So, you know what, you know, Jane read Pamela, like Franklin printed it. It was a big part of the Franklin story, the novel. So I wanted to think about using dialogue in certain ways. And I also wanted to think about Tristram Shandy and the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy, a gentleman, and the 18th century novel as a book that explores the private life, the private mind of an individual, and to let her be the thinker, the Tristram Shandy and what's going on in his mind instead of the Pamela, and we just sort of watch her fate.
Right.
I tried really hard to find a way to communicate to the reader that, in fact, in spite of her really incredibly scanty education, Jane really did engage with the big thinkers of the 18th century. She was this incredible reader. She would never have been able to read all the stuff. She wasn't Benjamin Franklin's sister, but he would send her books all the time. You know, so she would be reading Addison and Pope and Swift and all kinds of political philosophy. And she had views on these things because she had a kind of, I mean, think about what that would mean to be Benjamin Franklin's sister.
Yes.
And live in the house that Benjamin Franklin was born in and that you spent your whole life in while he just has this meteoric rise. You would be a pretty profound thinker about inequality.
Yes. And you have this wonderful appendix in here where you list some of the books that Jane Franklin read. In the letters that survive, the letters from Benjamin to Jane, do you get a sense of her opinions? Do you get a sense that he's engaging with her and that there's a back and forth? Or is it largely him sort of telling her about what he's doing?
No, that's a great question. You do see the exchange. And it's fascinating because you know that, I mean, it's patronizing at some level on his part, right? She's not his equal and he doesn't believe her to be, but he cares about her very deeply. And there's a certain way in which, I don't know if you're the person in your family who ran away from home, but I am. And there's a kind of way in which you need the people that you ran away from to stay the same, because right. You're defining yourself your whole life against who they are in a certain way, not in a negative way, but like, that's where I came from.
Right.
Those people are like that. And this is where I live now. Franklin needed Jane to be that. So in fact, one of the things he had run away from was Puritanism and a very particular providential view of the world. Like all things happen because God has a purpose. And Jane believed that her whole life until some very devastating losses all came together at once in the 1760s. And suddenly she sort of lost her faith. And Franklin kind of goes into this panic, like, no, you actually have to believe in providence. I don't believe in that, but I really need you. Distrust not providence, Jane. Distrust not providence. You know, he gets really sort of, he really needs her to be, to have a certain set of beliefs. And then, but yet there are other places where when she begins to think about the unfairness of being born to a certain kind of disadvantage and how hard it is to climb out of the trades, say, to be born into a tradesman's family, how you could move from being a tradesman to a gentleman. It's almost impossible. There's just very little social mobility. Franklin is like the only guy who does this. He loves that she figures that out, that that's unfair.
So this was not the first book written about Jane Franklin Meekham, right? It's her married name. Did you look at that book and come away with it with questions unanswered? And did you go into the book, into the research, having a kind of central question about Jane? And were you able to arrive at an answer for yourself?
So Carl Van Doren, who wrote this wonderful biography of Benjamin Franklin in 1938, won the Pulitzer Prize, is truly, this is my favorite one-volume biography of Franklin. He sort of fell in love with Jane, and he spent much of the 1940s trying to find her letters and is really responsible for collecting them.
Now, she actually was supposed to be a beauty, right? But
yes.
Speaking of love, but
yes.
There are no photos, yeah. no portraits of her.
Right, right. We don't know what she looks like. I mean, she's beautiful to me. But, but you know, it was the injustice of her erasure from history, I think, as much as anything else that moved him. And he really was determined to recover her and publish this volume of the correspondence, in 1950, it was published right after his death, and this little biography he had written of her called Jane Meekum was also published posthumously. And it's lovely, and it's really lovely, and it's really just written from the correspondence. But that's 1950. I mean, think about all the scholarship and social history and women's history and literary history that's gone on since then. So things like, you know, the average age of women at marriage or the infant mortality rate or what widows, how they stood under the law, whether they could own property, like this enormous wealth of women's history, especially, that's gone on in the decades since, that I was able to rely on to reconstruct her life and set it in a much
within
bigger
a
context.
All right. Well, it sounds like not just an update, really, but a major expansion on what we know about Jane Franklin. Jill Lepore, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The book, again, is Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's on the list this week?
Well, I'll talk about the hardcover lists, but before I do, I wanted to veer quickly over to trade paperbacks just to note that there's a new title making its entry at number one, and it is Alice Munro's Dear Life. So you win the Nobel, and suddenly your latest book becomes a bestseller.
Nobody's going to complain about that.
Yeah. On the hardcover lists, on the fiction side of things, a new number one book this week. It is John Sanford's Stormfront. This is the seventh book of his Virgil Flowers series. He has fun with it. It's kind of a Da Vinci Code cop book. It's got these real Da Vinci Code elements. But
in Minnesota? Or
oh, yeah. John Sanford's books are always Minnesota, yes. He was famous for the Lucas Davenport series, and then he veered off into the Virgil Flowers series.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this is. And it's pretty much a straight cop novel, but it drops these kind of ancient biblical elements into it, like a Da Vinci Code thing. And again, he has a lot of fun.
That works.
Then at number five, Mary Oliver's Dog Songs, which is a straight up book of poetry. It's been a good year for poetry on the bestseller list.
Indeed.
We had David Rakoff's novel in verse, Love, Dishonor, Mary, Die, Cherish, Perish.
And also, this is the Pulitzer Prize winning week.
Well, it's true. Mary Oliver won the Pulitzer almost 30 years ago for her book, American Primitive. She's built up a huge loyal following, almost dog-like in its loyalty, you might say.
There we go.
And she's built a career out of nature poems. This one is a little, maybe a sop to those readers.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little more whimsical than her usual. It is a book of poems about dogs.
And the subject, I think, of a very popular recent story in the Times.
That's right. Dana Jennings profiled Mary Oliver and just kind of talked about her popularity. And these, you have a very popular poet and a book of poems about dogs. And
also popular.
Exactly. So it's... sure to list. I'm going to just quickly read one of these poems to give our listeners a sense of whether it's a book for them or not, without passing any judgment. This is a poem called Every Dog's Story. I have a bed my very own. It's just my size. And sometimes I like to sleep alone with dreams inside my eyes. But sometimes dreams are dark and wild and creepy. And I wake and I'm afraid, though I don't know why. But I'm no longer sleepy. And too slowly the hours go by. So I climb on the bed where the light of the moon is shining on your face, and I know it will be morning soon. Everybody needs a safe place.
We can all tell that Greg is the poetry editor here at the Times Book Review.
So that's Mary Oliver. She's new at number five. And again, I think that may be the highest that a book of actual poems has ever entered the hardcover fiction list.
Oh, that's a record.
Yeah, really pretty extraordinary. Then at number six, Debbie May Comer, the longtime romance novelist, has a Christmas romance called Starry Night. This is a standalone. It's not part of her popular Cedar Cove series.
I think that Christmas books are very popular in October before everyone's sick of Christmas.
It's funny, isn't it? All these Christmas novels are hitting the list lately. Then at number seven, a new book on the list. Really, there's a lot of new books on the hardcover fiction list this week. At number seven, Dave Eggers has a new novel called The Circle. It takes elements of 1984 and The Inferno to really look at the tech world that we're in now. It's kind of the circle of the title is a company that really merges elements of Facebook and Twitter and Google to argue that we are just throwing away all privacy. And it's this real kind of 1984 dystopia.
Very timely with the news today that Facebook is allowing teenagers to reveal all to everyone.
And also the news that Google is now using our personal information to let companies advertise.
Insert ad here.
Then at number 8, Stuart Woods, longtime bestseller, has the 27th book in his Stone Barrington series called Doing Hard Time. At number 11, Doomed by Chuck Palahniuk is a sequel to his book Damned. Both are set in hell with Satan as a character. And at number 15, the last new book on the hardcover fiction list this week is by Robert Kirkman and Jay Bonansinga. It is called The Fall of the Governor, Part 1. And this is part of their continuing Walking Dead series of novels, which plays off the Walking Dead comic books and the Walking Dead TV series. They are now novels as well. This is, I think, the third book in that series.
And nonfiction, it looks like we have two very tragic stories by young women.
Yes, on the nonfiction side of things, that's right. The top two newcomers to the list. At number 4, I Am Malala by Malala Yousafzai with Christina Lamb. Malala Yousafzai is, of course, the Pakistani teenager who has been an advocate for girls' education and who was attacked for advocating education for girls. She was considered a front runner for this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Didn't win, but there's
time. She is a bestseller.
She is a bestseller, and she's young.
Yes. So.
At number 5, also, Elizabeth Smart's My Story, which is co-written with Chris Stewart. Elizabeth Smart is the young woman who, when she was 14 years old in 2002, was kidnapped from her home in Utah and held for 9 months before she escaped. And she's grown up to really be kind of an advocate for young women.
Right. Both of them are now speaking out for young women.
That's right. And then there are 3 more new books on the hardcover nonfiction list. They are all down toward the bottom of the list. At number 12, the prominent true crime writer Anne Rule has her first new book in a while called Practice to Deceive. That's about a 2003 murder in Washington State. At number 13, Daniel Goleman, who had a big success with his book Emotional Intelligence, he has a new book called Focus, which looks at just that, the science of paying attention.
Something new for us to do.
And at number 14, the prominent historian and investigative journalist Jesse the Body Ventura has a book called They Killed Our President, written with Dick Russell and David Wayne. I'm kidding, of course, about Jesse Ventura. He's a former pro wrestler and governor of Minnesota at one time.
Let it be said.
This book continues to make conspiracy case that he's made for a while that pretty much everyone you can think of was involved in the assassination of JFK.
Something tells me we'll be seeing more JFK on the list in the weeks to come.
Yeah, we're approaching the 50th anniversary of that assassination, and there's a lot brewing out there.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks so much, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.